Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Welcome to the Truth to Power Show. This is your host, VJR Nathan, and this is Radio Free Brooklyn. Today's guest is Sukanthari Svay. She was born in a refugee camp in Thailand shortly after her parents fled Cambodia after the fall of Khmer Rouge regime. They were sponsored to come to the United States and resettled in the Bronx, where she grew up. She's currently poetry editor for Newtown Literary, the only literary journal for the borough of Queens, yes, represent, founding member of the Cambodian American Literary Arts Association, the recent recipient of the American Opera Project's Composer and the Voice Fellowship for 2017-19, and the 2018 Emerging Poets Fellowship at Poets House. Publication credits include Homelands, Women's Journey Across the Race, Place and Time, Flesh, Prairie Schooner, Women's Studies Quarterly, Peregrine, and The Margins. Her first collection of poetry, Apsara in New York, is available from Willow Books. Welcome.
Thank you, Vijay.
Thank you. So why don't we start talking about when you came to America, what age, and how you feel about if you talk a little bit about your background and the book Apsara in New York, I know has a lot to do with, you know, the traditions of Cambodia and how contrasting with New York and American culture, or how it's adopted in American mm-hmm. culture. So we'll talk a little bit about culture and such, and first start with a little bit of your story. Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. So I was born in a refugee camp in Thailand after my parents had fled Cambodia after the fall of the Khmer Rouge regime, and they had crossed the jungle across the border, and then there I was. They were in a few different camps. Then we were sponsored by the International Rescue Committee and resettled in the Bronx, and that's where I grew up. So when I came to the U.S., I was a year old, so I was spared a lot of the actual, you know, experiencing of being a refugee and you know, living through the Khmer Rouge, thank goodness. But I was a witness and lived with my parents' trauma and their sort of survival mode.
Mm. Yeah, I know in the one of the poems, No Others, it mm-hmm. goes into, you know, the kind of utter, you know, loss and devastation in this family even. And this is something that's endemic in a lot of these families, where so many of the relatives have either died or missing mm-hmm. and only the few of them have survived. And it's amazing when I think about, you know, I'm someone who's, my parents had moved here from immigrate here from India, and you know, having lived here, and I'm like around the age that they would have come here, mm. and just thinking about how much courage and to leave your country, come to a new area, and you know, just start a new life, and it's must be doubly difficult when you don't have the kind of network, you know, all these kinds of things. So
the resources,
yeah, appreciating that, yeah, taking a moment to appreciate that, and how. Maybe we can read a poem about how with your daughter, bringing her up and appreciation and understanding of that legacy and that culture, but also, and, you know, in the process of assimilating into American culture, or rather, you know, bringing that culture and, you know, maintaining culture, preserving culture, but also being a part of America. Yeah.
Shall
yeah.
I read it?
Yeah.
Now?
Yeah. So you okay. go ahead. This is your inheritance, I believe. Yeah.
Yes. And it's yeah, actually really dedicated great. To her.
Yeah.
So, this is your inheritance for Surya. I see years of history before you, my Cambodian daughter. I named you in Sanskrit as the sun, a Hindu god. You contain the darkness of our genocide. You are the potential of our refugees to come back from near extinction. I see you in a stone homage to gods and kings among the Bayon's tower of echoing faces. You are the dancers Kambujin who wooed Rodin to that Paris dock, immortalized in watercolor. You'll be too much or not enough. They will mispronounce you, misspell you. Yogis will hear your name and think sun salutations. Remember, those who bow to your light must not burn from your sun.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about also about how you've grown as a writer and your influences. So focus a little bit on that, and where do you draw your influences from?
Gosh, you know, when people ask me, like, you know, who are your favorite poets, I always like cite the same two. Uh-huh. And that is Kimiko Han. Because she's like the one poet who I've consistently read. I have like six of her books, and I've read them over the years, and I always come back to it. Her and Aga Shahid Ali, his book, The Country Without a Post Office, really changed my life, especially at a pivotal point in my life where I was transitioning out of a relationship and coming back to myself. But also separating from my parents and trying to figure out who I was when I wasn't rebelling.
Yeah.
When rebelling became my identity. And what happens when you don't have that fight anymore. And then you have to figure out what's left, you know, who you actually are. And as far as like other influences, right now I'm reading Audre Lorde. And, you know, I've been sleeping on her. Like, she is incredible. I mean, just the confidence, but also just the fearlessness of just writing from this place where you know, as a woman, we often like apologize for everything, from the smallest things to like the large things about not doing enough. So her, I don't know. This is a hard question to answer because it's like, let me get everything that is important to me in my life and say it. But also music, actually. Music is a huge part of my life. Before I even wrote, I was singing and I was playing flute. So Mozart's Requiem was a really big influence because that was, I think, when I first heard it, I'd heard Lacrimosa in like, I was taking a gospel and contemporary gospel class because it was the only way I could sing at LaGuardia High School. I was a flute major. They wouldn't allow us to be double majors, but I kind of felt obligated to take flute because my dad bought me like a $150 flute. So I thought, okay. The rest of my life is going to be based on this cheap flute. But then I found a way to take like a voice class. I sat there and I heard it, and I'd never heard like really heard choral music before, Western classical choral music, and it changed my life. So then I was like, okay, I don't have any money. I got like $5 a day, but I have to find out where this piece is from. And so I bought. It was when a Virgin Megastore was still around at Union Square in like the mid '90s, and I bought Mozart's Requiem, and I listened to it every day. Twice a day for like months, for like, oh God, for like 3 or 4 months, because I knew that there was a longing and a quiet and a pain that I couldn't verbalize yet because I wasn't taught the words through my parents.
Yeah.
And we were speaking in different languages. So I learned, I think, real pain through music first.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I love also like R&B and soul, because it's just, damn. Black people have been through a lot in this country. Yeah. And they really know how to sing about pain. And I really, I don't know, I felt camaraderie with that pain.
Yeah.
Because we hadn't learned yet how to verbalize it as Cambodians.
Yeah.
So that is really my biggest influence, is actually music.
Oh, good.
Music of all varieties.
Yeah, it's so important to realize, you know, when you bring up the, you know, that we all as human beings experience that, but also like specifically how it's articulated through gospel and through blues and all that, and the cultural identification, the ability to articulate and bring the passion through music and lyrics, it's very powerful, and, you know, being able to connect with that human experience, and also the themes of generations in the book, you know, having to do with your mother's experiences and your experience and your daughter's experiences, and if you talk a little bit about just how you kind of communicate. The book has a lot to do with communication, and sometimes you have a very funny, very brief poem, but a very funny one about how, you know, your mother comes here and then does a typo on Facebook or something, and then it ends up being like a very strange cultural communication. I don't know.
I think you are the first person to use the word communication.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, there's like language, but then there's like really like communication and miscommunication, kind of misdirected. But that's my entire, God, my entire relationship. Right? My mom is like that. We've had a lot of misunderstandings because I would be using an expression, an idiom, and she'd be taking it literally.
Yeah,
and we had like a really bad fight once because she was like talking about, you know, there's a lot of. Gossip is like really rampant in our community. It's just like the passing of time is through gossip. But she was like talking about my younger brother's girlfriend at the time was just, you know, talking smack. And and I was like, you know, I don't care to talk about it. She's like, I'm good, you know?
Yeah.
But she's like, you don't care? You don't care about your brother? I was like, whoa, what? And I just had my baby. And then, and then we didn't talk for months. And, and then I went to like deep postpartum depression as part of that isolation from her and everybody else. Yeah. So, so yeah, language is really powerful.
Yeah.
Like really mess with you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, I think that also generations, the generational gap sometimes can, you know, but also the way in which, you know, older generations come to this country, immigrants come to the country, and then they, and then even the country is changing so much, and then how, you know, all the past, you know, people even lived here all their life, they have to adapt to changing times and such, and how we're able to, for my own life, you know, kind of bring to bear what my parents brought for me from the, from India and such, and whether or not how much I have to uphold that or how much I have to be American, and that, that tension, you know, and how to handle that. Yeah,
I think we're always going to live with that tension. That's just a part of our being, right?
Yeah,
being on that cusp.
Yeah,
you know, you talk about generations. I think, you know, I don't know why, but hearing you talk about, you know, it's always interesting to hear new people talk about the book and what I do, and it's still strange to me that I have a body of work that people can reference now. Before it was just like, I do this, and now it's just like, look at what you've done and like placed here and you put in this space. So it's just, it's still, it's really an honor still every time I'm asked to talk about it and to read from it. So thank you. But I was thinking about like the generations, since it somehow when you said generations, it felt different to me as opposed to the times that people say, oh, intergenerational trauma, which has become like such a phrase now, you know. But I think about like the miscommunications and the different media that are in here, like, you know, the Facebook, you know, or like, you know, letters or whatever. And just, or even like, you know, as an, as a, an incantation to my daughter, who I named after, you know, the sun god. But in Cambodia, we have Sanskrit loan words. So Surya becomes Soriya. So I, you know, I knew right away I wanted to name her that, mainly because the nickname Soya was so cute.
Oh.
Like the like soya bean.
Yeah.
That's actually what I call her. But should I read what?
There's another one I picked out.
Yeah.
I think it's Beneath the Ground, but you can also pick whatever you'd like.
You know, you said Facebook, so I have to
read that one. Yeah.
Oh, and there are like indentations in this book, so clearly you've been reading it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I was like, oh, this is always tough to find them.
Yeah.
Okay. So the story behind Good Luck Homie is that it started with, I mean, there's the one liner before it. And what had happened was, my mom, she wanted me to teach her how to like write some like key phrases to use in Facebook.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that that was really cute because she's actually being quite proactive about it. But she never asked my dad because he doesn't have patience with her. He's like traditional and just like, oh, I'm not going to teach you, you know. And then so she started using some of those phrases, but she misspelled it and said, good luck, honey.
Yeah.
She went, homie. And I laughed so hard when I saw that because I just thought, like, oh, that is unintentionally funny and really amazing. Okay, so this one's called quote unquote good luck homie.
Yeah.
You know my life good now, I know like I happy, I use the Skype, Facebook, and I not alone, I take the picture put on the Facebook and everybody like it, I not know how to read before but now I good, how you write beautiful, I want you write when I see the picture, my friends say how are you, look good sister. That how you spell? Oh my God, I never know. Now I know. I learned so much from you. You see, honey, you my good luck.
Thank you. Thank you.
But let me read Beneath the Ground since you had mentioned
it. Yeah.
Okay. Beneath the Ground. A prayer summons me back. Sutras revive generations who return with folded hands and whispers, a prod of incense. The earth is snug. Incense burns to ash. The monks you requested murmur in monotone, naked as their shaved scalp. I lie beside the rice stalks, as if only to smell incense from beneath the ground, awaiting harvest and rebirth. So I imagine that the Buddhist in you.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. I really appreciate how it melded in, you know, the imagery of the country, as well as the, you know, yeah, the themes of the rebirth and reincarnation, obviously. Yeah.
Well, the Buddhist background in me, it calls, and I'm constantly, like, trying to find my way back to it. I like to say that Cambodians are cultural Buddhists, partly because, like, you know, you get married, you don't have, you know, in the U.S., someone said to me, oh, yeah, my friend married a Vietnamese woman, and they had a Buddhist ceremony. It's like, it's not a ceremony. It's just a wedding. Yeah. It's just a wedding ceremony. You know, like, it's not a Buddhist wedding, you know. Because, you know, like, anything big happens, you know, a birth, a death, you go to temple. That's just what you do, unless you're a part of, like, that small percentage that is Muslim.
Yeah.
Or now this growing, like, Christian thing with all this proselytizing and and these missions that I don't agree with, but you know, using Christ as a way for people to get ahead, or bribing people to, you know, to turn toward Christianity. But,
yes. But I know even in India, you know, the problem has been, you know, Hinduism and this. Although they've kind of moved away from the caste system per se, but there's still this some, you know, trenches of that in India. That's why a lot of people have been converting to either Buddhism or Christianity, because they feel like a little mentally freed from the kind of baggage that Hinduism has brought. This is my understanding from things I've, you know, understood from people who have talked and all that. But, you know, some, especially people who are, you know, socially not mobile in India, they feel like they can kind of escape out of the kind of cultural baggage or the cultural understanding.
That makes a lot of sense, actually.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, because it does bring to them some kind of opportunity for, you know, connection with Christ, despite they're not judging in that sense that your karmic, you know. Sometimes people have that idea of karma as being very judgmental, you know, and that kind of judgmental, it's your karma, you did this to yourself.
Right. My mom is still like, you know, she's like, it's because I was bad in another life.
Yeah.
Like, she's convinced that that's why she has suffered so much this life.
But yeah, and then also, like, how your daughter has been, if you talk a little bit about kind of how you teach her the traditions and how, you know, and how whether or not you maintain that or how you...
Oh, I try so hard, you know. I think so much of whatever rituals we have, I associate with my parents. And now that they are both gone from New York City and they live in Georgia, my mom literally just retired, like, about over a month ago. And I'm struggling now to figure out how I can keep it, because I don't live in the Bronx anymore, near the other Cambodians where I grew up.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm here in Forest Hills, and the only Cambodian in Forest Hills, I'm certain. I would have found the other one. You know how it is.
Yeah.
We find each other. I know a couple of, actually, Southeast Asians, like Burmese, two Burmese, Lao and Thai. But and we have some similar overlap in our rituals, but it takes extra work when you are not around people of your background. You know this.
Yeah.
Rather than being so, what's the word? Being so strict.
Yeah.
Because I think that is a way of us judging ourselves, right? Like, it has to be done the way that we remember it.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to just be chill and allow myself to do it the way that I remember. And if I don't get it exactly right, that's okay. But I want my daughter, so I had to be able to witness it and to see it. Like, there was a point where I made a beautiful altar with, like, you know, rice wine and, like, fruits and candies. And then it was quite beautiful. I was very proud of myself. And we went, like, my partner bought, like, a vintage Buddha from Cambodia. And so we, like, burned the incense and, you know, we bowed three times. And she was, like, really into it. She's like, this is fun. Like, I like Buddha, you know? Or, like, she was, like, these kids, like, were like, pressuring her because she wasn't Christian, right?
Yeah.
And one of the, this other girl who was Thai and Lao, like, stood up for her. And I was just like, oh my God, this is, she was like, that's okay. I mean, I don't believe in Jesus, but you know, yeah. I mean, that's cool for you.
Yeah.
And she's like, we believe in Buddha, right, Mama?
Yeah.
Our family believes in Buddha.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't even know that I'm not like strict Buddhist in the sense like, you know, I'm going to temple and I'm doing all those things.
Yeah.
But for me, it's like, the presence of Buddha and is very strong in my life as a symbol,
yeah.
You know? So I consider myself Buddhist, but sometimes I feel like, am I an imposter?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I know, like, when my mom was, growing up, I actually grew up Hindu. So,
oh, okay.
So they kind of, in a vague sense, but, my mom was always like very critical of the traditions, like in the sense of when she did a puja, she'd want the priest to come in and do it shorter, or, you know, not go on for hours, do the essentials and, you know, make it clear, translate for the audience if there was any English speakers. She was very much into like essentializing,
oh.
You know, and kind of getting rid of the excess, because, you know, weddings can go on. My sister got married, you know, weddings can go on for days. So she wanted, you know, the essential traditions that she felt were important and have a translator there for the, you know, and always, you know, her ability to shift through that.
How long is an Indian wedding once you just get to the essentials?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And it can be as short as, very short. It can be very, like, a few hours or whatever. But
oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, the point is she wants to get down to the degree, but otherwise it can go on for days, you know. So
I feel like there's a point to that, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, there's a point to, like, the lengthiness. It reminds me in like of the chanting too,
yeah.
and the way that, you know, it becomes meditative. But yeah, you know, in these modern times,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
we gotta go, you
yeah.
know,
got yeah.
somewhere to be.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what else coming up for you as far as like the writing process? Or New Town Literary in Queens, connecting Queens writers, and you do. How is the Cambodian Literary Association?
Oh, God, that's a lot of different things. So let's start with writing process.
Yeah.
That changes a lot, which
yeah.
is really cool. Actually, after the book came out, which was last September, I felt kind of a drought. Perhaps you've been through this, you know,
yeah.
like once you do that big work and it's just like, all right, I'm done for a little bit,
yeah.
right? Because it just takes so much out of you to, like, go through the editing process. But part of it was I was worried that, like, all right, I'm done. That's
yeah.
it. I did the book. I'm done now. And I have a friend, Brian, who did not like it when I said that, even as a joke. He's always saying to all his Southeast Asian, like, contingent, finish your book, hashtag finish your book. Like, that was his thing. He'd harass everybody, like, finish your book. And we need to have that, I think, for us in Queens. But yeah, I think I was kind of going through, like, a dry spell with that. But also, I've been working on opera, and I'm working on fiction. So it's just, there's only so many things I can do,
yeah.
and yet I try to do everything.
Mm.
And I'm going to a PhD program in the fall, so I'm gonna have like the academic side of my mind, but the writing process, I can't like go to a room and be like, okay, I'm going to write now. For me, it's like, I find a lot of inspiration when I'm walking.
Yeah.
I think, because for me, that's very meditative. And then I start to like brainstorm thinking about one thing. Then I have to stop and I like, you know, dictate it on my phone and I'll come back to it later. Or the other day I wrote 4 pages of notes, and that was based on notes I got from some fellows in a workshop, because I've been writing stuff about marriage and just partnership and what that means, but also a woman in a marriage being like a form of currency, you know, anything about dowries and passing of from the father to the husband, you know. And I was there was like some bitterness in talking about that, about marriage in that traditional sense. So I took their comments and like they wrote notes from when I was talking about it, and they made titles. Like one they called a hypothetical baby.
Oh.
Because there was one guy I was dating a long time ago, and he got freaked out because I imagined what it would like it be like if we had a baby.
Oh.
And that like freaked him out.
Ugh.
And then that ended. And
yeah.
I thought, dude, it was a hypothetical
yeah.
baby. You know?
Yeah.
Like it's not a real baby.
Yeah.
It's like if you love somebody, you know, that has to be on your mind at least once. You can't like go over that.
Yeah.
So anyway, so things like that. And so I started free writing a hypothetical baby and like all these other things, like a woman is a currency or something like that. And like some amazing stuff came out. And then I was also reading some poetry that was given out to us. And I thought, let me respond to lines. So I think like for me, I need to read other people's poetry to get myself going.
Yeah.
So I bought like 6 books of poetry I haven't gotten to yet. Oh, yeah. But I did finish 5 novels.
Oh, good.
Finished reading 5 novels, so I'm on kind of a reading binge. And that's the other thing. We shouldn't just be reading our own genre. We need to be reading others because so people have so many different ways to write and approaches. And, you know, every time I read something new that I love, I'm like, why didn't I think of that?
Yeah.
Let me do that. Like, just things like that. Like, I'm always, you know, appropriating, stealing, yeah, borrowing, you know, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. Assimilating it. You
assimilating, know? Yeah. I think assimilating, yeah, would be good. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
And then...
Adopting,
so,
yeah.
So there's that. And then as far as, like, Newtown goes, God, I love Newtown. I don't think I can say enough good things. And I'm not just saying that just because I'm poetry editor. Yeah. But because they were the ones who welcomed me first into the fold. They were like, hey, come read. And hey, we like your we love your poetry. And then Tim, who is like, you know, the champion of Queens writers, Tim Frederick. And everybody on the team is just so wonderful and so caring. And they truly want to support emerging writers and create this community. And there was like one other Cambodian in Queens, but LIC, got her, you know, I met her at one of my readings. And then I was like, hey, girl, you should really submit. Her name is Bik Chanda Bao, and she's going to be hosting the Asian American Writers in Queens event. I think it's next month. And, you know, that was all because I met her at one of my readings. And then she got published, and she's like, she did 2 readings. Now she's hosting a Newtown reading. And Newtown is just like, we see you guys, and let's bring you in. And how do we make this place like where you go and you will know all these writers? And you know, the Queens writing community is small, but it's becoming well known. So we are all recognizing, if not all of each other, we recognize a lot of people either by name or when we get there. And I love that. It just feels very close knit in a way that I don't think Brooklyn is, like, because it's so big, because there are, you know, so many other options. It's like when you think Queens, like you think Newtown.
Yeah.
And I love that association. And it's going to be crazy being in a PhD program, but I don't want to leave Newtown. I think it's just, I get so much out of meeting the people who work with the journal and the people who come up to me when I've given them feedback. And that is really lovely to know that, you know, that I care so much about what comes in, and I want to make sure that we honor that. It hurts. It hurts when we can't accept the poetry, you know, because that's a real person behind those entries. So it's really good practice for me to always like figure out how to, you know, learn to read poetry that I wouldn't normally, you know, read. Mm. And then how to like make them known. I love Newtown.
Yeah. Good. Thank you. So maybe read one more poem and then we can kind of launch off from there. You can select something, you know, that you think is speaking to you right now, or...
Okay. So this is another, like, women, generations, and traditions, or, like, yeah, just cultural heritage. So it's called Daughter in Waiting. Oh, the first word is ma. That's one way to say mother.
Oh.
Daughter in waiting. Ma, I'm watching for your cues to know who's older, who's younger, more ancient, whose legs I can't cross over, whose head I must bow lower when I walk past, who deserves more respect, who is a brother, who is an uncle, ancestor, royalty, teacher, wearing titles that hold entire relationships, that determine worlds of dynamics, shift rooms and expectations. How much to widen the circle? How robust? I'm waiting, ma, for you to tell me if this woman is your elder or junior, if I should see her as my sister or aunt. I'm watching as you respond to different titles from others, but you are my mother. So, ma, tell me how to connect. So that one is like one of those like you poems, you know, you're like asking for something. And for me, I think writing poetry, the first poem I wrote was called Portrait of a Cambodian Lady, but it became this version, Portrait of a Cleaning Lady. And it was like this love poem to my mom to say like, you know, this is how I see you. This is who you are. And I remember it was like a intro to creative writing at City College.
Yeah.
And people were like really blown away. But I was like, oh my God, I just wrote by my mom. Yeah. like everybody writes about their mom at some point. But I thought like, oh, my words actually like affected people. And that's like, you know, things started turning in my brain. And I was like, okay, let me try this, you know? And for me, I think I've always been trying to get back to my mom. Like that's what this process is, to get back, go home to my mother, because I feel like I left her a long time ago. I think when I went to high school, I mentally like was trying to leave home and to replace mother with lovers.
Yeah.
You know, with friends. And then when I left, when I went into college, I moved out and lived with now my husband, but we weren't married then. And I would return home and she was a different person when I visited, as opposed to when I lived with her, you know? She was more patient. She would say things like, how are you? We don't say that to each other. We say like, did you eat, you know, and stuff like that. And so I was developing a new relationship with her that I'd never had before. One where we weren't fighting each other. One where we weren't always tense and like trying to force these roles on each other. You know, I'm forcing her. Trying to force her to be a mom that is recognizable to me based on American ideals. And she's trying to, you know, do the with me as well, but with Cambodian expectations. And so now it's like we're finally seeing each other, I think, more clearly for who we are. And so when I write this stuff, it's just a way for me to connect to the things that I remember.
Yeah.
And to also say, like, it's okay. And I don't have to fight it. But I don't have to accept all of it. So it's, for me, like a reconciliation.
Yeah, and I think in my reading as well, you know, the wrestling with, you know, with, you know, I think even with my parents' generation, coming here and wrestling with the ideas that you're talking a little bit about American ideals and how, you know, there's been such in the narrative, there's been such an idealization, though, at the same time of, you know, the Western narrative as being perfect and some of these, you know, countries like India or Cambodia or Asia as being like backward and stuff like that. And it's very troubling because, you know, even for my mom's generation coming here to struggle with realizing that, oh, you know, in America they want, their ideal is to have empowerment of women. But then, you know, then we're seeing this counter narrative coming up. You know, like my point is just being that, you know, it's easy for people sometimes to be judged these cultures as being, our cultures as being, you know, how do you struggle with that? Or, you know, we talk about Western ideals and you know, the kind of, you know.
Part of it is like the Western ideals of how we're supposed to be. I mean, that's when that becomes like the wallpaper of your upbringing, right? It's just, it's everywhere. And TV was our babysitter, you know, so we're like constantly watching it. And seeing like those family, like family ties or, you know, like seeing those shows with like those perfect white families with their sweater vests and you're like, you know, and they have family talks. You know, I remember my dad would like try to have family talks and it wasn't really a family talk. It was like, I'm going to dictate to you. Like you sit in a room, I call it a family talk, but I'm the father and I'm the dictator. I'm going to tell you what to do. And I remember sitting and like tracing the outline of the pillow like over and over because I was just like, this is not a family talk. And it was just, and I distinctly remember that scene. I don't know, just sitting there and knowing like I have no, absolutely no say in what's happening, but we're going through these emotions, right? It's kind of like with Christmas and Thanksgiving, you know.
Yeah.
You know, we're not Christian or, you know, but you know, that's it's practically secular anyway, the celebration of it. I remember one time we had, so we got a tree. We always got like a fake tree, of course. My dad wasn't going to like get a real tree. It's like, you can't reuse that. It's not cost effective. But I remember my mom got me a present. She had me help her wrap my present. So it's like kind of defeats the purpose of the surprise.
Yeah.
So I'm like wrapping, and she didn't have a box for the sneakers. So we're like wrapping the sneaker. Like, it looks like awkward, you know? So that was funny. Or like one time we, there's this whole like sweatshop thing happening where like a lot of the refugees, they would do like piecemeal work. So we're making bows and various things. And we had a huge mountain of like fabric and my mom's making bows and we like twist things and help out. But I remember we were making bows on Christmas once and we just ordered pizza. And, you know, I was like, oh, I guess we're not going to do Christmas. But it was like for us, like Christmas, we sort of did it maybe. It was like one year on, one year off.
Yeah, you know, that happened in my family as well. It was kind of like that as well. I remember always being disappointed by Thanksgiving and how I wanted it to be like I saw on TV or how I imagined people in America, you know, not, well, you know, people, my other people, you know, celebrated Thanksgiving. I was always disappointed. And some years we know we really hit it. Some years it was like off year or something. I don't know.
It was like we hadn't really had enough time to build that, like the ritual, like exactly the way it's supposed to be.
It was
inconsistent, I think.
Inconsistent, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because we're trying to like, we're trying to capture something that we're seeing and trying to translate it into our lives. But I think my family has gotten so much better, but it's been like 30 something years, you know? But before it was like, I remember there was always like a cranberry sauce issue where like, you know, my parents are fine with a canned, but when I first dated my husband, he like insistent on making cranberry sauce himself, you know? So he got the big bags and he does it. And, so tart. it was like juice and like and like too cinnamony, and I like nobody touched it. So after that he was like, okay, lots of sugar every year after that. And my dad is, that's the one meal that he has to be the one to make it. He won't cook most of the time, but he's like the bravado of, you know, I'm gonna make the big meat and the bird and all that stuff. Oh gosh. But now like those rituals are so important in my family, especially because they moved down south and, you know, I'm super white down there. So it's just like, yeah, everybody's gonna, they're always looking for excuses to get together, which I mean, that's natural, I guess.
But, yeah.
But I don't have that. I don't have that here. It's like they got to become more Cambodian again, moving down to Georgia, whereas I'm stuck here by myself and like reaching for like tendrils, you know, of like what is left of my upbringing. So I feel a bit of sadness about it. Feel a bit of loneliness about it. Oh, that's gonna be a poem.
Yeah.
Maybe give me a year though. Yeah. I gotta step away from the pain, you know.
Yeah. Just the holidays and how they've been reinvented and now you know, transplanting or kind of finding a place where we can bring something to the narrative, I guess the American narrative, and transform it in some ways, would you say is the kind of the end game or the next step.
Well, it certainly sounds like what my family is doing. Yeah. For me, though, like I think what I've learned is like I want to take what I remember and create these new things. So you know, I want to make my own traditions. I think that's what a lot of like parents do. Right. Especially now that, you know, my parents won't be around for forever, and so like, what do I do then? Like, and who becomes the authority on what is, you know, Cambodian the way that it's supposed to be. Like I thought about going to a temple and like, let me find out the right way to do the prayer, you know. I mean, I've looked up the Pali and I know, you know, like the three refuges and, you know, like and how to chant them and the Namo Tassa Bhagavato. But at one point am I going to be okay with just being Khmer the way I am? And to, you know, get it from my, for me, so much of it is piecemeal work from my memory. And then like a lot of the stuff I've written in here and what I've learned about the Khmer Rouge, that was all like my own research. When nobody else was writing about it, I didn't have anybody to look up to aside from like survival memoirs. For me, it was like, I have to be my own researcher. And that's what I would say to like anybody who comes from a traumatized community is like, be willing to go out there and look for that literature and look for the film, the resources, the music. So for me, it's like, I have that, but now, you know, then what do I do with that? Yeah. And then to heal from that and then also move on. Like you gotta like let it go at some point.
Yeah.
Is the problem right now with my community is that, you know, we're finally at a place where we have a new generation of people who can create new things that perhaps have the backdrop of the genocide, but don't have to focus on, like, let's retell the story over and over again.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you have, like, the Holocaust, like the Jewish Holocaust, and how there's always a new take on how somebody survived that. So I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
So I guess one could argue that we can keep writing survival stories.
Yeah, I mean, strangely, I was thinking, not the opposite, but I was in World War II in general has become, there's so many narratives of World War II.
Oh my God.
That it's like when I saw the latest one by Nolan, I was like, what is this really bringing to that crowded table I just felt like the film didn't bring for me it was visually interesting, but it, you know, being that it's a World War II, there's so much written, there's so much talked about, so much discussed about it, that I didn't feel like it brought a new angle to it.
Exactly. And that's what needs to happen if you're going to
well-trod territory.
My husband is a real, like, World War II buff. I think part of it is, like, he just, I think from what I understood from what he said is, like, he still can't get past the idea that that could be done, you know, to people.
Yeah.
And it's, like, the thinking behind that. It's the same kind of thing that's being explored, you know, historically with, like, with Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge. But it's triggering for me because it makes me angry. And I think I feel slightly more numb as a result of having read so many of these memoirs.
Yeah.
But when I see Vietnam, things about Vietnam, that actually makes me, like, angry. It reignites that. Maybe it's because, like, I have that distance as not being Vietnamese. But it starts all over again for me. So I have to be very careful how I approach things. Like, I don't want to be that... I'm not sure that I want to be that go-to person for the Khmer Rouge stuff anymore.
Yeah.
I am the go-to person for things Cambodian. And that's fine. I love that. That means people are thinking of me and they're thinking of my people. But I definitely don't want to be like, so what do you think of the Khmer Rouge? And it's like, you know what? I'm done talking about it. And I've done enough interviews to say, like, I want to be done talking about it. Or just like, how can we, like you said, like, find a new angle.
You know, at least bring something to the contemporary conversation, how we are able to see repeating patterns or see how identify with the what we're seeing now, being able to get that lens through to see it, not just talking about a narrative in the past, but rather how the repeating cycles
and I think that's
dangers of repeating and all that.
And that's what I love about using the Khmer Rouge as, like, a backdrop and to see, like, how new art from the diaspora is a result of that. And so, you know, what narratives are we telling now and how can we change those narratives? So that's kind of the stuff that I end up talking about, and especially with, like, the organization that I'm the board president for, the Cambodian American Literary Arts Association, or CLA for short. And CLA is actually the word for tiger, so you know it's like a kind of symbolic thing too. But we wanted to find a way to help our community heal and to, like, take stock of the writings of elders, as well as influence, inspire, and nourish and encourage young Cambodian Americans to use writing as a tool for expression and for healing. Because for the founders, a lot of whom are writers, including myself, that was what we saw as a form of power that is free, and also for so many of us, we don't have that community. And so we wanted to create a virtual community, but also, like, you know, a place where we can create classes. Eventually we'd love to have, like, you know, a retreat. We have submissions open for our, like, literary zine. So that's how I'm trying to help with the next generation. Because I want to be what I didn't have. I think that's what, especially, like, a lot of parents.
Yeah.
But people who are strongly connected to their community, you know, if you are a person who is giving or is giving back, and that's, I definitely want to give back. It's like, how do I give what I couldn't get or receive at the time? Mm. And also, I think of my daughter and how I truly want to give her access to anything and everything if she wants it.
Yeah, yeah, So one of the threads I'm thinking about is like how different communities have addressed like topics and areas like in mental health and in that, you know, in, I think Asian communities generally have, you were talking a little bit earlier about how the family talk and all these kinds of things and how we've kind of evolved as simultaneously to kind of bring out, you know, issues of upkeep and mental health and all these kinds of things and keeping and even as a community, you're talking about the trauma and such, but also the personal traumas, how it connects, you know, and how mm-hmm. we are moving forward and we're also responding to and seeing what the causes are and understanding as communities are able to, you know, respond to the, to bring something light, the light into the conversation, yeah.
Yeah, I think there are going to be more conversations as we go on. And I think the makeup of, you know, the new communities will be much more like racially, ethnically mixed.
Yeah.
And then you have like, you know, what happens when a community has been established in a country for a bit, and how that evolves, you know, like say like the Chinese in the Americas, or like the Japanese with like, you know, the several generations, those who have lived through, you know, the camps and as a, and been discriminated against during a war. And then, yeah, I think one of the things that I'm concerned about for our community is that we're going, I'm starting to see that there are less people speaking Khmer, Cambodian. Yeah. Mm. And that's just, you know, for a variety of reasons, you know, like those who, this a common issue is like a deletion of language is what they call it. When you, you know, young people go to school and their home heritage language is not valued and not seen as like, you know, a form of currency. And much like for Spanish speakers who go to school and then lose the language, you know, as a result, right? Same thing with, I get just about any other language. And so in this country, we've been taught not to value those home languages. And then, you know, parents who see like, you know, why are you speaking Spanish or, you know, whatever, you know, that's not going to help you graduate. You're not going to get money. Like, English is the language of money. And so I'm seeing that with like young Cambodians who can't speak. I mean, mine is okay. My Khmer is okay. But I'm still connected to the first generation, you know? I'm 1.5, meaning that I came of age here, but was born elsewhere. Mm. And the cutoff age is like 12, you know? Yeah. And so for us, we kind of live in between those spaces of like, you know, being Khmer or being American. And also I was born in Thailand, which is like, you know, of neither place that I identify with. So I was born in displacement and as a refugee. So to be born in a place where my parents are living under duress, it's not as clear cut for me, I think, for like my younger brother who's born in the Bronx at Jacoby Hospital. And he doesn't really speak Khmer. He's kind of shy or embarrassed about it. I have no idea, but he... Yeah. Never, he just doesn't, and it's strange for me, like how much I identify with the language, even as I stumble upon it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the main question for me is like about how, whether or not the response is to try to fight that and preserve, or whether or not it's inevitable that cultures will morph and change and become something new, and whether or not we put a value on just what the, you know, whether or not there's any judgment about. You know, oh, well, we have to keep this pure. We have to keep this, you know, the kind of counter narratives in this culture about how, you know, what's the most essential thing that we need to keep and preserve and what is something that we're willing to. And just like an example of my mother kind of essentializing the rituals and bringing it to modern context, that we're remembering what is essential and what is to be preserved and what is to... allow to progress.
That's a really great set of like rhetorical questions, right? I feel like we're always asking that, right?
Yeah, we're always thinking about that, yeah. Because even in my own story, like actually I adopted the Buddhist, my parents were born Hindu. You know, so I adopted Buddhist. So actually in some ways I've completely cut myself off from, you know, Western Buddhist now I consider myself, you know, so whether or not that's like it's just the way it is, but you know, I don't know. It has some connection to the Indian tradition, but I don't necessarily care to you know, preserve all these rituals and such. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, I think about like the iterations of what we're trying to get back to. Like, for example, okay, so I would love to, like, there's still that part of me, like, you know, that they're gatekeepers of our, yeah. I think for us, we, our parents can, or our countries can be gatekeepers of our rituals. It's like, yeah. Okay, here's how you do it. Do it the, whatever the proper way is proper, you know, quote, yeah. unquote. And so for me, it's like, I want to do it how my parents do, but I can't ask them without feeling stupid about it. Or they're just like, we just did what the other people yeah. did, you know? So I when I go to temple, I just watch them and they're like, tell me, show me how to do. But I, you know, nobody ever actually like explained the function of it. Yeah. So I thought maybe I can go find some, you know, Theravada Buddhist temple yeah. here, but you know, they're all run by Westerners, right? Yeah. And you know, they're white faces. And I feel a little odd about that as an Asian person going and having them be the ones to teach me. Cause it's like, they will teach me the rituals as they have learned it, but not in the way that I grew up with it.
Yeah.
And then I don't know that I want to bring that back to my home.
Mm.
You know, it's strange. It's like, you know, it's like the jumping back and forth in different ways. You know, it's like, do you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
It's like you want the way that your parents do it, but you have to go around them.
Yeah.
And that's what's happened with me for most of my upbringing, is that they wouldn't talk about things, and they didn't. It just, they were surviving. And so I the only way I could learn things about my culture and where I come from was by going around them, and going through books and going through other sources, most of the time Western sources.
Yeah.
And now it's like, oh, I'm, you know, considered somebody who knows a lot about it, but it's just like, I don't know, I'm doing the same research that you would be doing.
Yeah.
And legitimizing it.
Yeah.
So it kind of reminds me, actually, like, so the poems I wrote, my mother's voice.
Yeah.
And so it's written like in a very strange, like translated English way, or like in her English Khmer speak. So I'm doing a reading in Lowell, Massachusetts, the second largest Cambodian population in the country. And I've been asked to translate some of the poems. And I was just thinking, what would happen if I took a poem that was originally in Khmer that I translated, but then translated back to Khmer?
Oh, yeah.
And it's just like, you know, going through all the translation processes only to go back to the source. And it's like, what happens when you take a already translated poem and try to translate it back?
Yeah.
You know?
You'll probably find a lot of.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I discover a lot of subtle meanings and such, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of, it reminds you of like a, you know, when you used to like have cassette tapes and you like make copies?
Mm-hmm.
And I dated someone who's a recording artist, and he said when you record one copy onto another tape, it loses a generation.
Oh.
And I loved that, like that's actually the term they use. So every time you take, you know, like the album and you copy it, and then you take that copy and you make another copy, it loses like the sound, or yeah. the quality of the sound changes. Sound,
yeah.
Yeah,
changes, but, yeah.
Yeah, it changes. Yeah. But you lose, it said you lose a generation.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, whoa, that is so deep.
Yeah.
On so many levels.
Yeah. Yeah, good. So I think that's a good note to close out the interview. We just have a few more minutes. And so this is really great to understand, just to wrap up and to understand how, you know, even though things change and things morph and adapt and we survive, and what is that? Essentially, it's the essential is the person or the experiences. And I don't know, like there's something essential that is still Cambodian, is still Indian, that's still Southeast Asian or Asian. And you know, I don't know, that morphing aspects of it may change, but some things remain essentialized, you know?
So it's really interesting how you were able to take like the experience of your mother essentializing things.
Yeah.
And in essence, I do feel yeah. like, I do feel like that's what kind of what I've done here. I mean, you know, I don't know about you, but I still feel like this book could have been better. You know,
I feel like
but you know, but it's there. And so let's make do with what we have. Right.
Yeah.
So Yeah.
But it definitely has a snapshot of that struggle and then that that struggle with, you know, that we've been talking about cultures and cross-cultural and generational. Yeah.
Well, thank you for seeing it. Thank you for seeing it. And thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Truth to Power show on Radio Free Brooklyn. Radio Free Brooklyn is a community nonprofit that relies on donations from listeners like you. If you support what you are listening to, please also download the mobile app for iOS and Android. And also sign up for our newsletter, radiofreebrooklyn.org/newsletter. Now taking us out is from the album Dirty Computer. Here is Janelle Monáe's Americans. Please enjoy. Thank you.
Please sign your name on the dotted line.